Why don't you folks be seated for a second? And first of all, let me thank our marshals who have made sure that we have security today. Thank you, fellas, for being here with us. These are great guys and gals that are in the marshals, the Clark County Marshals. What a great organization they have. And Harriet Cummings is our clerk today. She's a lawyer. And with Harriet is Ms. Hendricks, who is recording everything that's happening today. And as I said, this is the time set for the case number 67922, Rushfield versus the State of Arthur Marvin. We have Mr. Wohola and Ms. Hoff representing the respondent. Mr. Wohola representing the appellants and Ms. Hoff representing the respondent. So what I'd like to do, counsel, is if you would address the audience. You could turn your back on us. It's okay. And give them a factual scenario of what your position is, and Ms. Hoff, you do the same thing. Yeah, this doesn't count in your time.
This comes.
Good.
Rob Wohola, I work for the Clark County District Attorney's Office. Most of the associated District Attorney's Office is with criminal matters. We also have a civil division. I have a civil division. My main duty is zoning matters. Zoning is when the applicants want to change the land use and come before the county commission and ask to change land use. That's my main duty. But we have other duties, and this case was just recently here. It's a civil matter. It's a case where a county employee driving a county car while on duty was trying to take a right turn on the Desert Road. Desert Road had a lot of traffic coming from this tiny Rushfield curve. Traffic was coming from her left to right car. She was trying to make a right hand turn and find out what was in the traffic. At the same time, she's trying to look to her right to make sure a pedestrian or a bicycle is going to cross in front of her. And what happened is, after a while, she saw another thing. She tried to make a right turn, and a bicyclist came out in front of her, and there was a collision. The bicyclist's name was Arthur Marvin. He was playing from his head. He was injured. He was taken to the hospital. He spent the night in the hospital, I believe. Then afterwards, he developed an infection and went back to the hospital and spent another 10 days in the hospital. The case went to trial. Jury instructions were given. One of the jurors, there were several jury instructions about whether or not Marvin was a pedestrian. It was our contention that he was not a pedestrian, that he was a bicyclist, he was a bicyclist. So one of the things the jury suggestion of the instructions that went to the jury that basically gave the jury the opportunity to decide whether Mr. Marvin was a pedestrian. The other issue that we're contesting is the attorney's fees, a cost that we're assessed against Clark County. We think that, first of all, that should not have been assessed against Clark County, and secondly, we think that they should have been assessed against Clark County, but they were not apportioned properly because there were other defendants, and some of the costs should have been charged against the other defendants. So those are our main issues. We have a lot of legal issues that we'll present to the court, and I guess I'll turn it over to Ms. Hoff.
Ms. Hoff, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. This case is a case about a driver who chose not to pay attention while driving and see what was there to be seen in the crosswalk. In this case, the gentleman was riding his bicycle on the sidewalk, came to an intersection, stopped, looked and saw a driver of a car, stopped at another stop sign, proceeded into the intersection, and through the intersection, gets slammed into by a car. He goes up onto the hood of the car, slams his head into the windshield, and is hospitalized for the injuries and that, and an infection he got in the cost that he had for a couple of months. He had over $200,000 in medical. Because that driver chose not to take responsibility for what she did, we were forced to bring the county to trial. At that trial, the jury heard the facts of this case, both from Arthur's perspective, I was the trial lawyer, and from the county's perspective. The jury decided that the county, the driver of the county vehicle, Connie, was 80% responsible, and that Arthur was 20% responsible. So that they assessed responsibility to both of the people that were involved. But because the county was more responsible, Arthur was able to recover from the injuries that he received as a result of being in that car. So the issues here on appeal are, number one, whether he was allowed to be where he was, and the judge decided that he was in the start of the jury. There were issues of whether or not he was a pedestrian or not, and that rests on whether or not the definition of a pedestrian is whether or not a person is a foot. That's the definition of the law, right? So what is a foot? The jury was instructed that a pedestrian is someone that's a foot. Arthur testified that he had stopped and put his feet on the ground to look, and then it sort of pushed off and was shuffling in the intersection. So the judge decided that that's enough for the jury to hear what that definition is and make their decision. We don't know what that decision was for the jury. They didn't talk to the doctor and tell us. But we do know that they assessed responsibility to both of those people. And that they were instructed over on, what is the law and the law. So that's one of the issues. Because we won the trial, the jury actually gave us $20,000 more than we asked them for. Because we won the trial, the law allows us to hold the county responsible for forcing Arthur to go to trial and have to pay for some of the things that they had to pay for in order to get access to the court. His attorney's fees and the cost of litigation, you're going to hear about some of those things, very expensive to go for trial, and the trial judge determined that they should be sanctioned or punished for dragging through the trial ultimately to gain a more than that all the
Thank you both. Great explanations. Mr. Rojola, you're up first. Now, the appellant has 15 minutes, and so does the respondent. But the appellant can reserve part of their time, part of his time for rebuttal. Do you want to reserve part of your 15 minutes?
Yes, I would like to reserve 5 minutes.
Okay, so he'll argue for about 10 minutes, and then Ms. Hoffa will argue for 15 minutes, and then he'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Okay, Mr. Rojola, you're on.
May it please the court. I'm Rob Warholer, Clark County District Attorney's Office, representing Clark County and Ms. Connie Rushfield in this matter.
Let me make sure that, can the audience hear the attorney?
I don't think it's on.
Check the.
Oh. Do you know where the button is? Uh-oh.
This is why they're lawyers, by the way.
I think it's working now.
Now can you hear Mr. Rojola?
Can we start the time?
Go ahead.
Okay.
We'll give you a few extra
I think
seconds.
I need the extra.
Go ahead.
I'm Rob Rojola, Clark County District Attorney's Office, representing Clark County and Ms. Connie Rushfield in this matter. I'll refer to Clark County and Ms. Rushfield collectively as Clark County. I've asked for 5 minutes for rebuttal. I've already explained the facts of the case. I mean, it's a situation, I know what Marjorie said, but it's not that simple of a situation. It's not a situation where Marvin's standing in the crosswalk and Ms. Rushfield runs her over. The situation is more what I think every driver has faced. You're trying to take a right, you're looking left because the traffic's coming from the left, and you're trying to keep your eye to the right because sure enough, some guy or a pedestrian or a bicycle is going to cross in front of you, and you got to keep an eye out because you don't want to hit him. Unfortunately, in this case, there was an accident. There was a complaint. The complaint named Clark County Ms. Rushfield, but the complaint also named Sunrise Hospital. Sunrise Hospital was named because Arabella Street is right next to Sunrise Hospital, and there was bushes and landscaping that the plaintiff, Marvin, alleged blocked Ms. Rushfield's view as she was going to make her right turn. And so that's another key fact in this case. Now, what I would like to address first is the reason why we don't think the jury instructions were proper. And one of the reasons why is because there were conflicting orders. Clark County, after a while, moved for summary judgment. Plaintiff Marvin, we moved, the plaintiff Marvin was not a pedestrian as a matter of law because he was not a foot. NRS 484A-165 defines a pedestrian as a person who is a foot. Sunrise Hospital also filed a motion in limine and a motion asking the court to take judicial notice that plaintiff was not a pedestrian at the time of the accident.
Mr. Rowell, can I ask you a question? I read the record. Didn't the judge, Wiesk, conclude that that Mr. Marvin may have been dragging his bicycle along, you know, with his foot on the ground, and that, that it was an issue of fact? The jury would have to make a determination whether he was a pedestrian or was actually riding the bicycle across the crosswalk.
Yes, that's correct, but that was after the jury trial. At the time of summary judgment, the facts were clear that Mr. Marvin was not a pedestrian. In the complaint said Marvin was riding his bicycle in the crosswalk. In his deposition, Marvin testified that he was riding his bicycle, that he slowed down but he did not get off his bike. Even at the summary judgment hearing and in the motion for summary judgment hearing and the motion for judicial notice and motion in limine that Sunrise Hospital brought, plaintiff's counsel even argued that Mr. Marvin was sitting on a seat and pedaling slowly. So at the time of summary judgment, the facts were that Mr. Marvin was a bicyclist. He was not a a pedestrian. And in the court then, at the time of summary judgment and the motions brought by Sunrise Hospital, he concluded, I don't think that there's evidence that he is a pedestrian. Then the district court judge then granted our summary judgment motion. The district court granted Sunrise Hospital's motion in limine and judicial notice. It made the oral pronouncement. A week later, the orders were entered. One order for Sunrise Hospital, the order that granted judicial notice, found that Plaintiff Marvin was not a pedestrian at the time of the accident. The order entered regarding Clark County said Plaintiff was not a pedestrian as a matter of law if he was not a foot at the time of the subject accident. So it's two conflicting orders.
Mr. Warhol, understanding that the court made that ruling prior to trial, after hearing evidence but prior to closing argument, the settling of instructions, wasn't there some dialogue between counsel and the court referencing instructions given as to that conflicting order?
At the time the order was entered, there was discussion about whether or not that language should be entered into Clark County's order.
But I'm looking more specifically at the settling of jury instructions, since that's what you're objecting to. Wasn't there some comment by the judge about it was something for the jury to decide?
Yes, but that's my next point. What the judge found was that Marvin was possibly dragging his feet. That was after the testimony he heard from Mr. Marvin. And our contention is possibly dragging your feet is not the same thing as walking. If you look at the Del Piero case, it was a situation where I think the plaintiff was straddling his bicycle. And this court found that he was walking. And if you look at the Del Piero decision, it states that he was walking like six or eight times. But walking is, that is the quintessential act of being a pedestrian.
I guess the question really is whether or not, since we come down to that finite point, was it a factual issue that the trier of fact, the jury, had to decide based upon the evidence presented? Because a trial is a moving thing, so sometimes situations change.
Right, I understand that the situation changed. I think that the plaintiff tweaked or modified their position because originally before motion for summary judgment, they were arguing, if you look at the complaint, he was riding a bicycle. That's what Marvin testified in his deposition. That's what the plaintiff's attorney argued. At the point that summary judgment was granted in favor of Clark County, then it became, well, maybe his foot was on the ground. They kind of changed their position. And in Clark County's order, instead of entering an order that conformed to the court's oral pronouncement granting summary judgment in favor of Clark County, an order was entered that basically vacated the summary judgment order. It said, well, he's not a pedestrian as a matter of law if his feet were on the ground. There was no motion to vacate, no motion to reconsider. And that order that was entered on the same day conflicted with another order that the judge entered on the same facts in favor of Sunrise Hospital that took judicial notice that Mr. Marvin was not a pedestrian as a matter of law.
Well, legally, though, and again for the student's benefit, a judge may make a pronouncement in court, and then that pronouncement is memorialized in a written court order, but doesn't the written court order supersede the oral pronouncement? Isn't that what we as an appellate court have to look at?
Yes, but there's two conflicting orders. There's one order for Sunrise Hospital that says, no, he's a bicyclist. But for Clark County, it doesn't say that. It says, well, he might be a pedestrian. So there's conflicting orders, and that's what I'm arguing, is that that's textbook arbitrary and capricious when you treat two defendants differently on the same set of facts. So it's our position that you had conflicting orders. The court properly found that Mr. Marvin was not a pedestrian, and the jury instructions should not have gone to the jury. And the second position is what I just argued a second ago. Even then, after hearing Marvin's testimony, the most the court concluded was Marvin was possibly dragging his feet. Well, possibly dragging his feet does not equate to walking.
Well, Mr. Warhol, again, maybe Justice Chair will give you some additional time, but for the student's benefit, why does it make a difference legally if Mr. Marvin was walking his bicycle across the crosswalk or was riding it? Why does that matter?
Because there's a different standard of care. If you're a pedestrian in a crosswalk, a motorist owes a greater duty to make sure that they watch out for you and don't hit you versus a bicyclist. If a bicyclist on a roadway has similar or almost the same duties toward a motorist as a motorist has to the bicycle. So if you give jury instructions to the jury that Mr. Marvin is a pedestrian, then he automatically has an advantage because the jury is thinking, just even in their minds, that, hey, it's a motorist versus a pedestrian versus a motorist versus a bicyclist. And of course, we all know that pedestrians walk slower, and a bicyclist might be moving faster, and it also affects, I think, the jury's decision in a case.
Well, so in this case here, let's say you're a student at Valley High School and you live on the other side of Eastern Avenue, over on the east side of Eastern Avenue, and you're crossing Eastern Avenue on Vegas Valley Drive to get to the campus, and you have a bicycle, so the smarter thing to do would be to walk the bicycle through the crosswalk as opposed to riding it across the crosswalk, because if there's an accident then. Is
correct.
That correct?
And the state has published guidelines that are mandated by Nevada law that we attempted to get into evidence. We asked that Mr. Story, who works for NDOT, Nevada Department of Transportation, that he authenticate these documents under NRS 52.025. We wanted to authenticate them and publish those documents to the jury showing that, first of all, that a bicyclist should get off a bicycle and walk across the crosswalk. Secondly, that when you're going down the road, you shouldn't ride in the opposite direction of traffic. And then third, you should make eye contact with the driver and make some kind of communication so you know what the driver is going to do to avoid an accident.
Okay, now my understanding is the judge, when you asked him to allow these documents to be admitted into evidence, the judge felt that, number one, they were hearsay, meaning the witness was reading what the documents say. He didn't have personal knowledge of them, and that they were not legally relevant to the facts of this case. Am I correct? Was that the judge's conclusion?
What I recall, Your Honor, is that the judge found that it was an opinion, and he didn't want to allow opinion testimony. I don't recall him saying anything about it being hearsay. Mr. Story.
That was the argument of the other side. It was hearsay, I believe.
Well, it's a document that's published by the state. I think it's a public record. I think there's an exception to the hearsay rule.
Okay.
And also, I think it's relevant material because it establishes the standard of the care for a bicyclist in relation to a motorist.
Isn't that document a guide?
Yes, it is a guide. But still, I think it's relevant material to establish the standard of care a bicyclist owes to the motorist.
But that's different than a stated law.
That's correct. It's not a law. It's definitely not a law. But there are a lot of guides and safety manuals that I think courts look to the standard of care and safety practices that people should use in certain situations.
You're into your rebuttal time. Do you want to reserve your time that's left?
Yeah, well, I do want to talk about attorney's fees and apportionment real quickly. It does take 1 minute.
Go ahead, and then I'll give you some extra time, and I'll give Ms. Hoff some extra time.
We were charged all the attorney's fees and costs for the entire case. I guess there was joint and several liability. The court did not make the findings required under the Gunderson and the Mayfield cases. There's no findings at all. If you look at the order granting the attorney's fees and costs, there's no findings at all saying that Clark County There's no attempt to actually apportion it on the cost. There's no attempt to say that apportionment is impracticable. On Gunderson, there's no analysis under the Gunderson factors. There are absolutely no findings at all. I looked in the order. I looked in the transcript of the hearing. On that basis alone, the court abuses discretion, and then I'll get back to the other attorney's fees and cost issues, I guess, on my rebuttal period.
All right, now I'm going to give you your full 5 minutes on rebuttal, and Mustafa, I'll give you 16 minutes instead of 15 minutes. When you're the judge, you have to be even-handed to both sides. And as you approach, I hope you'll start off by, please approach. Start off by talking about these conflicting orders. It's very confusing as to conflicting orders by a judge in a trial court. Start with that, Ms. Hall.
Certainly, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Marjorie Hoff, and I was Arthur Marvin's trial attorney. The county has paid the $100,000 cap towards the judgment in this matter. Because of that, most of what we've just heard from the appellant is moot. Because this court is not, it's not this court's duty to render necessarily advisory opinions, but to resolve actual justiciable controversies, the majority of what we've spent this time so far discussing is moot. The verdict, the classification of the client as a pedestrian versus a bicyclist, the jury instructions, the evidentiary ruling, those things are moot because they've already paid the $100,000 statutory
cap. I thought it was supposed to be stayed pending the appeal. Did I misread that somewhere in the documents? When did it change and the county decided to go ahead and pay the statutory amount, which we'll explain to the students later what that is, but when did that happen?
I believe it was in September, actually, before the case was briefed. You can find it in Appendix 8, pages 1565 to 67. There's a stipulation in order which states that that they're going to pay the $100,000 cap plus the post-judgment interest, and we would agree to stay the execution attorney's fees.
Thank you. So the issue today is the costs and attorney's fees have not been paid, so we're still arguing over that.
Correct. The attorney's fees and costs are still a justiciable controversy. Certainly because Justice Cherry asked, I would be happy to address briefly the conflicting orders with regards to the pretrial motions. So what happened in this case, Mr. Warhol has misrepresented what Mr. Marvin said in his deposition. The reason the court he didn't alter his ruling. What he said was, what he's always said is, which is certainly not an abuse of discretion and an accurate depiction of the law, an actual accurate statement of the law, that if Arthur was afoot, then he was a pedestrian. If he wasn't afoot, then he's not. And that's exactly what his order said. It said that he's not a pedestrian if he's afoot. Nobody ever asked him. Before trial, nobody ever asked him. It wasn't in an interrogatory. It wasn't asked in his deposition. And at the time of trial, we didn't know what the testimony was going to be. It turned out that it was that his feet were on the ground shuffling. And as a result of that, the judge appropriately determined, did not abuse his discretion by, used sound reasoning in determining that was a question of fact that needed to go to a jury, whether or not that fit the definition of a foot.
Did you say he was sitting on the seat of the bike, or was he off the bike and walking the bike?
The testimony was, and it wasn't clarified beyond that, that he had stopped at the corner, he had stopped to the point where he had to put his feet down, looked and saw the car, decided to proceed into the intersection, and that he was pushing off or shuffling his feet. Where his rear end was, whether it was on the seat or not, we don't know.
But both the legs were straddling the bicycle.
Yes,
it wasn't like he was off the bike and walking the bike.
He was not off the bike, walking the bike to his side, but just like Del Piero, in Del Piero it was different, because in Del Piero the testimony was only that his feet were squarely on the ground and he was walking. In this case, the definition of pedestrian is afoot, and because the testimony was that he was shuffling his feet, that then goes to the jury. That's a question of fact for the jury. It's certainly not an abuse of discretion for the court to allow the jury to be instructed on that question of facts and make the determination. Unless Your Honors have any other questions, I'll turn to the issue of the attorney's fees. Of the remaining issues on the attorney's fees, which I have as the appropriateness of the offer of judgment, the appropriateness of the Lodestar attorney's fees being awarded, and the appropriateness of the costs. Is there a specific area that you would like me to start with?
Well, Mr. Warhol is saying that there should be an apportionment on the fees, that you wouldn't be entitled to the whole amount because you had the Sunrise in the case previously, and therefore the judge should have apportioned them and made findings on that. What's your position on that?
And also, I need you to explain, because we do have students here, what an offer of judgment is, and when you mentioned the word lodestar, what is lodestar when it comes to attorney's fees?
Certainly,
this sort of a learning process for all of us.
An offer of judgment is a 10-day time limit offer that is presented to an opposing side under the rules of civil procedure and staff, and at this point, the late 17115 statutory law that allows a party to make a non-revocable, in other words, the offer's out there, it's out there for 10 days, you can't change it, you can't take it back, they have that amount of time to pay it.
Okay, now, if I could interrupt, Ms. Hall, again, just for the students, and it's like, for example, here, I think you made an offer of judgment of $99,000 in this case. So what would happen then is if you won more than $99,000, in addition to whatever you win, you could go back and ask that the other side also pay your court costs and attorney's fees. Correct? Is that how it works?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. And with regards to a lodestar simply, there are different ways that you can calculate how attorney's fees are paid to an advocate for their client. And the lodestar would be simply an hourly fee, the amount of time you spent and the hourly fee you charge, versus a contingency fee, which is a percentage of the recovery. That's a way that a lot of attorneys like me, plaintiff's trial attorneys, practice in order to give people access to courts. Because most people, you'll see the attorney's fees in this case, the hourly fee was $118,000. You know, certainly my 77-year-old client didn't have $118,000 to pay me in order to be able to go.
What were you awarded? Were you awarded the full amount?
We were awarded $118,000 in attorney's fees and change.
And your costs also.
And we were awarded costs. The costs were reduced. Some of the costs were foregone because I did agree with the county that some of those were only applicable to Sunrise.
Okay.
So we withdrew our request for those costs specifically applicable to Sunrise, and the trial judge also made a determination that some of the costs were not taxable against Sunrise and did reduce our costs.
Weren't some of the attorney's fees, though, money that your client incurred through your services to defend or to prosecute Sunrise Hospital as well? So why wouldn't there be an apportionment, as Mr. Warhola argues?
The reason there's not an apportionment in this case is because this court has said that there's no reason to prohibit the imposition of joint and several fee liability where a losing defendant has caused the plaintiff to suffer a single and indivisible harm. So in this case, we have two potential contributing factors to causing Mr. Marvin to be hit in that crosswalk. One is the county driver's decision not to pay attention to see what was there to be seen, and the other was the hedging that was at that corner that she always maintained did not block her view. That was a large part of the decision, a large part of the reasoning in our decision to settle Sunrise Hospital out. She said it didn't block her view. When she finally said that, we decided to settle them out. Now, but this is still one indivisible injury against multiple defendants. We then have a situation where, after we settled them out, the county then wanted to change their tune and actually brought a motion before the judge in opposition to our motion that they exclude the discussion of the hedging at the trial. They wanted to argue that it did block her view. So whether or not Sunrise had been in the case, this came from the traffic accident report where the investigating officer at the scene said this hedging may have blocked her view. We would have had to have done that discovery anyway, whether Sunrise was in there or not. And certainly the district court didn't abuse its discretion in determining that that was a single indivisible injury. Deciding anything different now, this is the person who sat through the trial. I mean, you've all been trial judges. We've all sat on the bench and gone through trials and certainly know that as a trial judge, you're in the best position to determine whether or not, I mean, that's the person that heard the facts of the case, heard all the pretrial motions, heard the interaction between the parties, understood the theories of the intricacies of the theories of a case like this for the 2 years that it went on. So it certainly wasn't abuse of discretion. It wasn't unsound judicial judgment in deciding that those should not be apportioned and that they should be joined several, as this court has instructed they're allowed to do. Certainly, this court isn't in the habit of, and I've never seen you simply substitute your own judgment for that of the trial judge.
So your point is that we decide this case not on what we feel the results should be, but we have to defer to the trial court judge that heard the evidence and heard the trial and give deference to that decision unless it's clearly erroneous as far as when we review it on appeal.
Right, unless they've abused their discretion in their application of the law. In other words, they didn't appropriately apply the facts, the law, or made some unsound judicial determination that deserves being overturned. And that's just not the case in any of the different factors that are brought before you today. Judge Weiss's reasoning was sound. His order on attorney's fees and costs was sound. He explained to us that he considered the Beatty factors. He explained to us that he considered the Brunzell factors. You have the transcript where he went through those, but his order, as is all that's necessary to be, specified that he went through all of those factors and made the determinations that essentially, number one, was a tie. Both the claim and defense were in good faith. Number two, that the offer of judgment was brought in good faith. Because he went through that reasoning for you, in the transcript of the hearing on the attorney's promotions, fees, and costs. He went through that reasoning and explained his reasoning that, you know, when you're looking at whether or not an offer is reasonable, the county wants you to believe that just because this was an offer that was at or near the statutory cap, that it's per se unreasonable. They actually say in their brief, when you have an offer near the cap, there's hardly any incentive for the county to accept it. And I urge you, Your Honors, to give them some incentive to accept it.
Well, first of all, I don't think that matters because the jury doesn't know about the statutory cap, do they? They just decide the case and the judge deals with the statutory cap after the verdict's entered. So would that even matter, the statutory cap issue?
I think the statutory cap issue matters with regards to the reasonableness of the offer of judgment. In other words, had I done an offer of judgment for $300,000, certainly that would be unreasonable, right? They're never going to have to pay $300,000.
Right.
But because we knew what the cap was, we knew that this gentleman had $200,000, more than $200,000 in medical expenses alone, not counting his physical pain, not counting his mental anguish that he went through.
So again, for the student's benefit, like if you're in an accident like this, the damages that are potentially recoverable if the other side's at fault is not only the medical bills, but any pain you have, which you call general damages, and future pain you may have if you have an injury that's going to last into the future. So all that can be considered by the jury. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, sir. And certainly, the judge did not abuse his discretion in determining that even if they found Mr. Marvin half at fault and reduced only his medical bills, mind you, the county had no medical expert. They had no medical expert. There was no doctor that was going to come in and say support the theories that they set forth in their brief, not on direct examine, not on direct, not even on rebuttal after we named our expert.
Counsel, if we can go back to attorney's fees specifically, using Lodestar, how was it established what was reasonable in this particular case? What evidence did you produce for the court to review that the fees that you were charging as to the hourly rate were appropriate?
So provided with the motion for attorney's fees and costs was a spreadsheet with an hourly breakdown of the work that was done, who it was done by, the amount of time spent, and the hourly fee charged by that particular attorney. The trial judge examined those motions, heard oral argument on the motions. He reviewed those timesheets and made the determination that that work was reasonable and necessary and related to the prosecution of the case.
Well, when we talk about Lodestar, was there anything established that was reasonable within the community?
Yes, Your Honor. There were affidavits of other attorneys in the community that were attacked. There's also the discretion of the judge. Again, we're talking about an abuse of discretion here.
I understand what the standard is. And to properly exercise the discretion, the judge needs information. That's why I'm asking you what was presented.
Yes.
To know that there was adequate information presented.
There were affidavits provided from other attorneys in the community that the fee amounts asked for were customary within the community for the type of work that we do. The county is arguing that you should be only because we were on a contingency fee and a contingency and 45% of $100,000 is 45 and that's all we should get. Now while I would love for you to give us a per se order that a plaintiff's attorney is always allowed our contingency fee, because our contingency fee is almost always higher than our lodestar factor, than our hourly fee. And while I would love to have that ruling, I don't think it's consistent with what you've said in the past, what you've consistently said through shoot and other cases, that the trial judge is in the best place to determine what the fee award should be, and it will not be disturbed absent an abuse of their discretion, and that they can use any method to calculate that as long as they can justify it. And in Judge Weiss's order, he did justify that. He took us through the Beatty factors. He took us through the Brenzel factors, the quality of the work conducted, the amount of time spent, the difficulty of the case. This was a hotly contested case. This was a case that went on largely because of the county's misunderstanding of the law. We spent 6 months arguing about whether or not a bicycle could be on a sidewalk, and there was no law about that. That gives me my one last minute wrap up, Your Honor. Is there anything else you would like me to specifically address?
No.
All right, then I would just close with this. Certainly, the judge in this case has established, the trial judge has established, that the basis for all of his decisions, both with regards to all of the issues that we're dealing with here, the jury instructions, the evidentiary issues, and certainly the fees and costs issues, he's brought a well-reasoned opinion forth that allows you to support his decision and not simply replace your judgment with his own, as that would be the situation. I have about 10 seconds left that I just wanted to address Frazier and just remind the court that the Frazier case came out after this trial was heard, so Judge Weiss did use the appropriate law that was in place at the time in order to be able to make his decisions, and he talked about those cases, you know, the Yamaha case, Beatty, Brenzel. There were other cases that talked about the reasonableness of the expert's fees, the Gilman case, Barasini, of course. So those cases were in place, and he did a rule consistently with the instructions you have given in the past with regards to those.
Thank you, Ms. Huff.
Thank you.
Mr. Rojola, you need to talk about whether or not the issue of liability is moot.
Like the court is heading that way, so I'll move on to attorney's fees and costs again.
Was there a stipulation or anything in preference being paid? The fact that it was paid doesn't necessarily make it totally moot. It just makes...
I understand there was not a stipulation that rendered the issue moot, that we could still appeal it, but that we wanted to pay it so we didn't have to pay interest or anything. But I wasn't handling the case at that point. I just came on just recently, and so that's why I'm not exactly familiar with what exactly the situation was. Again, back to the issue about whether or not there's a single indivisible injury under Tarkanian, I don't think that issue is really relevant here. I think the issue is whether or not the court actually addressed that issue at the trial court level and made those specific findings under Gunderson for attorney's fees, under Mayfield for costs. There's nothing in the order, and I could find nothing in the transcript of the hearing where the court actually made that analysis and looked at those factors, and based on that alone, that's an abuse of discretion, and I believe the court should reverse it for that reason. The other issue is, I'd like to go on to attorney's fees.
Sure, please do.
Under Rule 68, and when it applied, Rule NRS 17.115, the language of Rule 68 said that if an offer of judgment is exceeded and the Beatty factors are satisfied, that the Clark County could be responsible for the attorney's fees actually incurred by the offeror. It doesn't say actually incurred by the offeror's legal counsel. The language says actually incurred by the offeror. Now, plaintiff Marvin actually incurred 45% of $100,000, $45,000, because that's what the amount of the judgment was. It was a 40. The judgment was the statutory cap's $100,000. 45% of $100,000 is $45,000. Attorney's fees are only permitted if authorized by statute, rule, or contract. There's no statute or rule that exists that grants authority to award fees more than was actually incurred by the offeror. There's one reference to contingency fees in Rule 68 and Rule 17.115, but that only says that the attorney's fees awarded are supposed to be deducted from the contingency fee, and then so that the plaintiff only has to pay the difference.
Well, let me ask you this. That's an interesting question with the statutory cap. I never heard that argument on attorney's fees. The jury verdict was for $209,000 for past medical expenses, $125,000 for pain and suffering, $20,000 for future pain and suffering. So I'm doing some quick arithmetic. That's about $350,000 the jury awarded. They found the your client 80% negligent, so you take multiply that by 0.8, so that's divided by 5. Okay, I'm doing some mental arithmetic here, so that takes it down about 70,000. So that's about 280. So that's before the statutory cap. They actually won $280,000 for the jury from the jury. Shouldn't that be taken into consideration on the attorney's fees?
And I would say no, because they always knew going in that if you sue Clark County, there's a statutory cap. It's $100,000, and the most you can get is $45,000. They could have contracted for hourly fees if they wanted to. They chose not to. They entered into a contract with the plaintiff for a contingency fee. If they knew there was going to be more attorney's fees and why aren't they charged by the hour, then they could have come and asked for more fees. They didn't do that.
Well, most clients can't afford to pay by the hour, you know, in these negligence cases. That's to give them access to the courts, the attorneys have to agree to take a percentage and not charge anything up front to give people a chance to go to court to protect their rights and file these claims. So,
right, I understand, but still, the amount actually incurred by Mr. Marvin was 45% of $100,000. And I'd like to briefly address Beatty.
Okay.
Before the court ever even considered the Beatty factors, the court said, he announced, if somebody beats the offer of judgment, I usually award fees. So under Rule 68 and NRS 17.115, I'm going to award attorney's fees. Then he does this cursory review of Beatty. And he didn't really address, if you look at the order and you look at the transcript, he doesn't really address the issue about whether or not the offer was reasonable in timing and amount. There's nothing in the order, basically. And if you look at the transcript, I think there's 10 lines where he kind of gives it, just barely addresses it. And if you look at the order, in fact, it just says that the offer was made in good faith. It doesn't say it was reasonable. It doesn't say it was reasonable in good faith in timing and amount. It doesn't say that at all. It just says it was made in good faith. And so I think under Frazier, the trial court must carefully weigh the Beatty factors and carefully consider them. And it's our position that he did not do that at the trial court level.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This matter is now concluded. This case will be submitted. The court does thank Mr. Rojola and Ms. Hoff for your briefs in this matter and your arguments. And ladies and gentlemen, let's give these attorneys a round of applause.